This is The Conversation. It's episode 212 with Denise Marconish. She's a curator at Mass MoCA, as in Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, in North Adams, way up in the northwest corner of the state of Massachusetts. And that is an immense venue. According to Denise, 300,000 square feet of exhibition space. Can you imagine? As I was looking around my notes in preparation for talking to you guys, I noticed that Scott Ogden of the Gallery Shrine in New York City, our guest from last week, is the king of 350 square feet of space in his gallery. So I thought that was a beautiful contrast. And you know, when it comes down to it, we're all just people, aren't we? I'm Michael Shaw, and the website for this podcast is still theconversationpod.com, where you can see various images of Denise doing studio visits out and about just about everywhere, as well as some of the shows that she's been involved with, including Nick Cave, a very, very popular show there. You can also find the archive of past episodes, donate to the show, leave a nice review on Apple Podcasts through the website, etc. One of the things we talk about is the show O Canada that she curated a couple of years ago. Some 400 studio visits in preparation for that show over 3 years. Talk about scale. We talked about a lot of great stuff that she's been doing with Mass MoCA and what it's like being a curator slash producer. She likes the title producer, as you will hear, putting together shows and including O Canada, where she went all over Canada to, Vancouver, to find artists and what a studio visit means. It's having a conversation, just like this show. On the back end, I am going to tell you about the art fairs, and there's a little bit of complaining going on about art fairs in general and what they are doing to galleries and so on, just in time for the New York Art Fairs of this spring. So this is going to come out on this, hopefully maybe the Friday of the week/weekend of spring art fairs, including the Armory and all the satellite fairs and so on, spring break, etc., that are going on. So it's perfect timing as far as I'm concerned. I'm also going to give you a really high recommendation I have for a digital slideshow that I saw that's going to blow your mind, blow your heart, actually, more specifically. So that's all coming up on the back end. In the meantime, what else can I tell you about my conversation with Denise? Well, I can tell you that included among her comings and goings around the country and beyond, she was passing through LA. So she came over to my place and we recorded. Let me tell you a little bit about what kind of environment we recorded in. She first made her way into the proscenium, then, you know, traipsed for a good 5 to 10 minutes across the house, out the back of the house, through the backyard, the jungle in the backyard, into my funicular, one of those carts that runs along a track up steep hills. So she took the funicular up to my mountaintop recording studio, and that is the environment in which you will hear this recording. So hope you guys are doing well. I'll talk to you more on the back end. Stay tuned for all that stuff about the art fairs. So you're a curator at Mass MoCA. I thought a good place to start would be, I have not been there.
Okay.
I am reluctant to say, or I'm embarrassed perhaps to say. And is it North Adams is the town?
Yes,
North Adams, Massachusetts.
Yep.
So why don't we just talk about the context of the museum as far as if you have a rough breakdown of like the percentage of local visitors versus people from New York and Boston and so on.
Yeah, I don't know actual percentages, but mm-hmm. I would say we definitely are an international audience. And what's really interesting is when the museum was first set up, they realized we're off the beaten path. And we're huge. You know, right now we have close to 300,000 square feet of exhibition space.
Oh my God.
But
let's stop for a second. Is that the most museum exhibition space in the country, at least?
I think, yeah, for non-collecting contemporary museum, we're the biggest. Yeah.
So what kind of space, what kind of collecting space would have more square footage than that?
I don't know. I mean, I'd have to look at that, but like, you know, places like the Met and stuff like that would have more square footage because of also housing collections and all of that. But we're pretty massive.
and your most, perhaps most well-known space is the, you can tell me what number it is, but it's the football size space.
Yeah, that's building 5.
How much square footage does that end up in?
That's about 18 to 20,000 square feet. So it's a one long processional space, which is the length of a football field. And then there's two smaller spaces attached to it.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. And then just this spring, last spring in May, we opened a new building, which doubled our space.
Wow.
And so it's all for mostly for long-term engagements with artists.
And it was built or it was just there?
No, existing.
Wow. Yeah. How far away from the original
connected
building?
So
what was it before?
It was just empty. It was actually our storage.
Right.
And of course, then we were in the compromising position of like having had, you know, 120,000 square feet of storage. We had stored many artists' artworks after their shows came down, and we were in the compromising position of having to call them and be like, we can't really keep these anymore. I know the show ended 10 years ago. So it was this Herculean effort to sort of clear out that building so that we could renovate it.
Well, what did you and or artists think was going to happen with works that had been sitting in storage 8 or 10 years after a show?
I mean, I think there's always the hope that somebody will want to show it. You know, one of the challenges we have is that our spaces are so big and we tend to do very monumental projects is that not very many places can fit them. You know, where I'm just sort of starting to find some institutions that have kinship with. So like I did this big show with Nick Cave last year, and that's traveling to two venues, one Carriage Works in Sydney, Australia, and then Crystal Bridges in Bentonville, Arkansas. And they actually came on early as co-producing partners. And so we were able to also, you know, up what we could do and band together our resources, and then the show will at least get to have another life.
You know, we will get back to the context of the museum in a second, but you brought up one of the things that pricked up my ears, the Crystal Bridges Museum, which is associated with one of the Waltons.
Yes.
And is in a part of the country that's not one that one would associate with cutting edge contemporary art. So why don't you talk about, first of all, if this is like a first time deal for them to have this kind of show, and then either first or second, talk about how this collaboration came about and how it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I actually went to Crystal Bridges for the first time last fall. And I was shocked when I got there. You know, I was there on like a Monday morning at 10 a.m. and their parking lot was full. And you know, and I guess I could say the same of like a place like Mass MoCA, which is, you know, again, off the beaten path, that there are these certain museums that are destination places. And that one really has become that. I think for them, contemporary art is not something that they were originally used to. Of course, they did the State of the Art show, which I think was pretty groundbreaking for them. And so they're working on, which will be called the Momentary, and it will all be for contemporary art and performance. And so we knew that they were working on that, so we approached them about Nick Cave being a great show for them to either start with or within their first year. So they realized that, you know, we have the fabrication team who knows how to build a sort of spectacular exhibition. They don't have that at the moment, and that it would be a great partnership. And of course, Nick is an artist who's in their collection and, you know, draws incredible crowds wherever he goes. So it, for them, it was a really nice fit. But yeah, it'll be really interesting. I think with this new venue, they're also trying to up their contemporary programming and try to sort of, you know, capture some of the younger people who work in town and things like that. So
I know this isn't your expertise, but do you think that, and I can't remember her name, but the Walton who's the founder of that museum, do you think that she's been able to distance herself from the controversial side of that name?
I don't know. I mean, I think somewhat. I think the idea of, you know, somebody who's using that money for art is great. And I think there's always going to be people who, you know, it's the same thing that happened with Philip Morris, you know, changing their name to Altria so it wouldn't be associated with the brand Philip Morris. So it's that same kind of thing. But, you know, the fact of the matter is like the art world will take it where it can get it.
That's a very good point. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Okay. And rather they use it for good stuff.
Right.
You know?
Well, yeah. And I was just reading about, you probably heard about the Sacklers.
Oh, yeah.
So it's, what's her name? Claire? I think it's Claire. I could be wrong. Anyway, a Sackler granddaughter, I guess, is working on a very intense film that takes place in a prison. Oh. There was a New Yorker article about it. And so there was a very short amount of the article that sort of mentioned, and she kind of wrote it off kind of the way that you did. It's like, you know, you take it where you can get it. You know, I don't have anything to do with that, you know, and clearly she doesn't. But it's always interesting to look at these sort of, you know, controversial tie-ins.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just in the studio visit I was in just before here with Have Carman. We were talking about, you know, funders who are maybe voted for somebody that we didn't vote for. And that, you know, those kinds of funders and board members exist out there, and how you balance that. They are doing good in supporting these nonprofit institutions and art, but you might not agree with all of their politics. So it is like this weird slippery slope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, how much of your job would you say do you find yourself wondering whether you're compromising your integrity?
I would say about zero. I think MassMoCA is super unique in both the creative freedom I get there as a curator. I was once giving a lecture and somebody asked me the question, you know, what is the process you use to get an exhibition okayed? And I said, I don't understand your question. And they're like, well, do you write a proposal and submit it to your director and then you present it to the board? I said, no, I just do it. And I said, sometimes my director will say, that sounds great. Other times he'll say, I don't know, prove me wrong. But either way, I don't ever feel like I've had to compromise. You know, the only times compromise comes in is with budget.
Right.
But that's not like a moral compromise at all. So, but I think we're pretty unique in that.
And do you have a sparkling clean board in terms of their associations and whatnot? Your endowment?
Our board is awesome. I know that, but.
So in other words, I guess maybe more sort of specific way to look at it is that your job does not require you to be not only a fundraiser, but, you know, even sort of cognizant maybe of some of the less glamorous parts of the curatorial world.
I mean, I definitely am involved in fundraising and, you know, talking to galleries and talking to collectors and trying to my best in helping write grants to support what I want the artist to do. But, you know, I don't necessarily always get down into the nitty gritty. It's usually very like exhibition specific and things like that. It's not overall raising money for endowment and things like that. Our development department is really good at that.
And does your development department write the grants and you like sort of give them what they need? Or?
Yeah, so it sort of will start with, I'll write a kind of show description and I get bios of artists or whatever. So, you know, a one page thing and give it to them and they'll research what grants might be good and then they'll tweak it for whatever the grant asks for and send it back to me. So it's like a real sort of collaborative back and forth.
Right. Okay.
Effort.
Right.
Yeah.
but you get to be sort of on the writerly creative side as opposed to the sort of mucky muck,
yes.
you know,
yeah.
or in the muck
yeah.
side of
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And of course, like, you know, I mean, like I said before, our board is awesome. And so like, I love interacting with them and they're really supportive of that freedom and, you know, a big part of, us being the institution we are, because they just understand who we are and let us be that. So, you know, we're right. again, lucky in that respect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And speaking of which, back to the museum itself. So I think you told me, you will correct me, but your location is like, you're about 3 hours, is it, from everywhere?
Yeah.
So 3 hours from New York and 3 hours from Boston? Okay.
Yeah. It's very funny because I'm always like, it either takes 10 minutes, an hour, or 3 hours to get
right.
anywhere.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So when you describe that parking, that full parking lot, you mm-hmm. know, that you come upon, is that only on the weekend or do you see that during the week too?
It's so fascinating. You know, I've been at the museum now 10 years, going on 11. When I first got there, you know, in the summer, always full. But in a, you know, now January, February, you would hear crickets. And that's not the case anymore. Our parking lot is full almost every day. We actually have to have off-site parking now because our parking lot is not big enough.
Wow.
And, you know, I think it's more people finding out about us. It's these expansions that we've done and these sort of long-term exhibitions. You know, having 9 Terrells doesn't hurt. Nick Cave's show was a huge driver of people coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really interesting balance because, to go back to what we started with, where our exhibitions range anywhere from 10 months to 35 years or 30 years, but we have a huge performing arts program and performances we do every week. And so, if you're somebody who lives locally, you can come to the museum and see the exhibitions once a year, which is great for tourists because they can travel there once a year and see all the shows we do. But for our local audience, they come every week to see a movie, to see a band perform, to go to a dance party,
mm-hmm,
you know? Mm-hmm. So that's it. It then allows us to have an active local community without having to have that pressure of changing over shows so often, because it's kind of, it takes us a year to sort of turn the whole museum over.
Right.
You know.
So, but on a given day where the parking lot is full,
mm-hmm.
how much of that would you say is local? What percentage is local versus having driven or more
yeah.
to get there?
I don't know. That is an interesting question. I'd have to dig into that. I mean, I think it's, on a given day, museum, it's probably more heavily geared towards people who have traveled. But like on a weekend, when we have a performance, it might be about half and half. But
right.
I don't, you know, I'm making that up.
Well, you know, just, right. But I'm just thinking, I guess, in terms of as a visitor, yeah. as a theoretical or potential visitor,
mm-hmm.
let's say I, you know, go to New York and I decide, okay, on Thursday, I'm going to go drive over to Mass yeah. MoCA to check mm-hmm. it out. And this is just the personal, you know, artist bias side
right.
of me. I don't want there to be too many people, but I go there
right.
and then it's like, I get there 10 o'clock and
yeah.
like the parking lot's full. And I'm like, you know, great for you guys.
Right.
Not so great for me.
But think about it. 300,000 square feet. You still have a lot of space to see stuff.
Right.
And not, it's never going to get to that point where you're waiting in line or you're jostling to get in front of something.
Right.
And the spaces, you know, they absorb. We always joke that, like, we'll have an opening and we're like, oh, it didn't look like there were a lot of people there. And then we look at the numbers. We're like, there were 600 people at that opening.
Right.
So it's one of those things where I've never heard anybody complain. You know, I think in our new building where we have the James Terrells and Laurie Andersons, that was the only time I've seen anybody frustrated, because both of them, there's experiences you have to sign up for. And on a busy weekend in the summer, there were sometimes people couldn't get appointments. But that's the only time that's
Do you have the happened. Perceptual cell?
No.
Okay.
We have a piece called Perfectly Clear, which is a Gansfeld, like There was one here at LA Mocha where you sort of walk in and it's the curved big room.
Right.
With the, so we have a new one of those. Mm-hmm. And 8 others.
What are the pieces or piece that are going to be there for 30 years?
Well, Saul LeWitt, 105 wall drawings. This fall will be the 10-year anniversary of that opening, and that's a 25-year exhibition. Terrell, I don't know what the exact timeline on Terrell, but that's like 20 years. And then there's things like Laurie Anderson, where mm-hmm. we're engaging with her for 10, 15 years, but we'll do rotating shows. The same with Jenny Holzer. Louise Bourgeois will be there for a good long time.
Right.
So it's a really interesting model, sort of museum within a museum. You know, we don't have a collection, but we have these things that we take care of for a long time that people can come back and see as if it were a collection.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have our regular program of changing exhibitions. So it's a really interesting balance between those things.
And just to sort of maybe put a final point on the context or the audience of the museum, how big is the local attendees? I mean, I presume that it's an area. It's not just the local area, but it's an area of whatever, 25 miles, 30 miles or something.
Yeah, we sort of look at our community as almost that 3-hour radius. And that's for both performing arts and visual arts. You know, because if we have a concert with the Decemberists, we're going to get people from Boston and New York who are going to come for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then our more immediate is about probably a 40 mile. So looking at places like Albany and Troy, New York and Bennington, Vermont and Hudson, New York and of course, North Adams, Williamstown, which is the next town over, which of course has the Williams College Art Museum and the Clark Museum. And then our neighbors to the south, about an hour away is Tanglewood, which is classical music, Jacob's Pillow, which is dance. So it's this kind of incredible cultural corridor.
Right.
Yeah.
So does the summer get pretty crazy?
Summer's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And are you around for that? Or
I am around for that. Uh-huh. I mean, I always go away a little bit in the summer because we never change exhibitions in the summer because we don't want to have any space closed.
Right.
But it's also an exciting time to be around. There's always... there's always something crazy happening.
Right, right. Okay. So you're here. We're here in person, which is nice. And you're out here in LA doing several studio visits.
Yep.
How often do you get on the road to do this kind of R&D or whatever?
Frequently. I mean, it's the most important thing that I do is getting out there and having conversations with artists. I mean, I remember when I first moved to North Adams, lots of people said, well, what's it going to be like to live there? And not that I lived in New York or LA, I lived in New Haven. It was a city, and, you know, small city. But I was like, it's not the middle of nowhere. And I don't just stay at home. So, you know, I would say I spend almost half the year getting out and meeting artists and, you know, so much of what I do derives from these conversations that I have.
See, I was really intrigued by the way that you phrased that, because you said half the time I'm out on the road or, you know, so much of what I do is being out on the road, having conversations with people.
Yes.
That's a very pointed way of putting it. And, it's distinctly different from just sort of, I go out and I do studio visits. You know what I mean? It has a very different kind of feel to it. So,
well, studio visits are conversations for me. Like I was, you know, said I was at a studio visit this morning and I was telling Haive about how I like to approach doing a group show. And it's not that I like to start with a very narrow thesis and say, well, your work fits into my narrow thesis. I like to start with like a huge amorphous idea for this show, the human condition. It's ridiculous to start there. And then finding a group of like-minded artists who I've had interesting conversations with and working with them over a year, 2 years, sometimes 3 years. And through those visits and those conversations we have, the show becomes what it is. I see it as a really collaborative thing, because it's not interesting for me to just impose my idea on other artists'
right.
work. That
right.
together we make what it ends up being.
Yeah. You know, it's the subtext, though, that I feel like is coming through is that, at least that I'm imagining, is that the artist is having a conversation with you the first time, and you've introduced this premise to them, mm-hmm. and they're implementing some of that conversation and premise of your show yeah. into what they're making.
Yeah. Yeah, I like to think of that premise as a prompt or a right. call to action kind
right,
of thing.
Right, right.
And that's,
it's like a soft sell.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You don't have, I'm not gonna say you need to make this,
right.
but I'm gonna plant a seed
yeah.
and get you to make it
mm-hmm.
in my own way.
Right. Yeah. It's so much more interesting because then it also gives me the opportunity to be surprised at somebody else's take on this open prompt.
Right. Yeah. So with this artist that you were using sort of as an example,
yeah.
have you already made it clear that they're in the show?
Oh, yeah.
And so are these studio visits, for example, that you're doing on this trip? I mean, I know one of them is a one person show, but,
yeah.
How many, I guess the question is, how many of your studio visits that you do are you already clear with them and yourself that they're going to be in X show?
I'm usually pretty clear, but I also like to do studio visits to just meet artists and see what's going on out there. So,
yeah.
The exhibition I did in 2012 called O Canada.
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah. It was a perfect example yeah. where I was interviewing for my job at Mass MoCA. And our director, Joe Thompson, said, what kinds of shows would you do if you came here? And I said, well, I think we should do a big show of Canadian art. And he said, that sounds great. Why? And my first response was, because I think it'd be funny. And it was more complicated than that. I said, we're in this point in the art world where I knew more artists from China than I did from Canada. And I was like, why is that? Like, Canada's our nearest neighbor. And then I looked at the history of exhibitions in Canada. They hadn't had any kind of survey of Canadian art in over 20 years. And so I just said, well, then I've just got to go and see what's there. And did 400 studio visits. 62 artists were in the show. I've since worked with other artists who weren't in the show. And like that to me... research is my favorite thing to do, whether
right.
it's sitting down and reading a stack of book or over 3 years meeting 400 artists, because that just drives everything else.
I'm trying to be sensitive about reconciling your sort of innocent and totally positive kind of description, of putting together that show, because when I saw about the show and saw about the 400 mm-hmm. studio visits and so on, one of the things that I was thinking, and I hope, or I would imagine that a number of artists might have these kinds of thoughts, like, what is it like having that kind of king-making power, and regardless of that, one of the questions that I wanted to ask is, how many of those 62 artists that wound up in the show's careers were... Mm-hmm. immensely impacted by that show.
Yeah.
Do you think?
It's an interesting question. When I was starting the show, there's of course that notion of like, I'm an American. What does it mean to be going to another country? Is it any different from the curators who are going to China? And I had, all of these moral quandaries about that. But I also just wanted to learn about something I didn't know about and do it as deeply as I could. And of course there are artists who were not happy that either I didn't visit them or that I didn't include them in the show. I mean, I always joke that the city of Vancouver hates me because I didn't put in Jeff Wall, Stan Douglas, Rodney Graham, all of whom I think are excellent artists, but it wasn't about showing what we already know.
Well, they shouldn't have been pissed off. I mean,
I don't think they were, but I think people in Vancouver were pissed off on their behalf, even though I don't think they cared. you know, just this thing of like, well, we're known for this photo conceptual thing and you didn't represent that. And I was like, Well, isn't it better to show something that isn't getting represented? So I was looking at what wasn't getting represented in America, but also trying to ferret out things that weren't getting represented in Canada either.
Sure.
And you know, I was always really honest about that show. And even when I wrote about it, I said, this is personal. I am not claiming that this is a, you know, democratic survey slice of a country. That's impossible to do.
Sure.
But it was the choices that felt right at the moment, the artists I was responding to. If I curated the show now, it might be a completely different show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times curators don't like to admit that personal choice is part of what we do. You know, it's kind of like a dirty little secret, but I think it's an important part of what we do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I definitely think, you know, a lot of artists had great opportunities coming off of that. Like one of the artists who was in the show then represented Canada at the Venice Biennial.
Who was that?
BGL, which is a 3-person collective from Quebec.
Okay.
But also I've just seeing the artists, you know, and I follow all the artists still, and you know, there's just amazing things that are continuing to happen.
Do you think the 62, the demographics, was proportional to the cities, like the biggest cities of the country, or was it?
It was pretty proportional. Mm-hmm. And that was one thing I was careful about. Like I didn't want to just show artists from Montreal, Toronto. You know, I went to the Yukon in February and went on a studio visit that I could only access the studio via snowmobile. And that was, you know, an important thing to do. And so there were artists from every province and 2 of the 3 territories. I just couldn't find anybody in the Northwest Territories, and it still haunts me. And then also looking at, like, you know, making sure that there were First Nations artists and Inuit artists in the show as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, I fell in love with, you know, I love Toronto, Montreal, they're great cities, but I fell in love with, you know, Nova Scotia and this little town called Sackville, New Brunswick, or, you know, Saskatchewan, and these places where, you know, there's just amazing things happening.
How do you find a contemporary artist in these far-flung places? Yeah.
My rule is always, if an artist tells me to see another artist, that I go.
Yeah.
If a curator or a gallerist tells me to see another artist, I look them up and then I decide. So I started out with a few curators and a few artists I did know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the list just kept growing and growing and growing. And I'd say, you know, to somebody I know in Montreal, hey, I'm going to Saskatoon. Do you know anybody there? And then that would help grow that list.
Right.
So it was very kind of grassroots thing. And sometimes I'd have my whole itinerary planned out and I'd be at an artist's studio and they're like, you know, so-and-so lives down the road. Do you have time? And I'd always make time. I mean, I was doing 4 to 6 studio visits a day.
Right, right. Wow.
Yeah.
So what are some of the, just without focusing too much on the Canada show, what were some of the takeaways just from doing like a barrage of studio visits? I mean, clearly you're a studio visit expert, as it were.
I was going to say junkie.
Junkie, sure. Okay, that's a good way to put it. But you have to have had, you know, some unpleasant studio visits, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely had weird scenarios. And, you know, this was 2008, 9, 10. And, you know, I didn't have a smartphone then. And I remember there were definitely moments where I was like, I was driving in Saskatchewan and somebody, you know, said, oh, don't miss the exit because then the next exit isn't for 40 kilometers. And then when you get off the exit, turn at the yellow mailbox. And I'm like, what if they painted their mailbox and I'm stuck out here and I die in my car? You know, I had all of those moments.
Right.
Lots of people were like, did you have an assistant with you? I was like, no, I did everything myself. I would have an assistant help me put itineraries and print me maps and all of that. And then, yeah, and I had like some super awkward studio visits where it's like, you know, I thought they were, you know, maybe there was some interesting stuff in there. And then I got to the studio and we just like had nothing to talk to. I mean, it goes back to that conversation idea. I always say to young curators, if they ask me like, well, how do I do a studio visit? I said, it's not even about looking at the work. It's about the conversation you have. You'll always have time to see the work.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's real awkward because I also think it's important to spend time. So for me, a studio visit, they were scheduled as 1 to 2 hours.
Wow.
And like people who go in and spend 5 minutes, I see that as disrespectful to the artist because the artist is going through it too. So there were those moments where I'm like, okay, I gotta at least get 45 minutes of conversation here. And, you know, and then there were weird things, you know, as curators and artists, we do this crazy thing where we willingly go into strangers' houses and let them into ours. And there were some moments where I was like, I don't know if I should be in this house.
Did you feel unsafe?
Like, there, well, not unsafe, but just like, you know, like going down into somebody's basement and ducking under their laundry line with their underwear hanging on it. And so you're just like, I can't believe I'm doing this. Like I'm going against all the stranger danger. But I yeah. do it anyway.
Right, right.
So, yeah. And then there were certainly, you know, there are people who, from walking in, I immediately knew I wanted to work with them. And there were people who that's a kind of slower burn. And then there's people who you immediately walk in and you're like, this isn't going to work. But I don't want to be in the business of like crushing people immediately, you know?
And that's generous.
Yeah. And so it was also important to me that when I was sending out the emails of, yes, you're in the show, I also sent out emails saying, I'm sorry, you're not in the show. So it's not like they would just never hear from me again.
That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's good. It's good in the art world to be human.
It is. Oh, God, yes. Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that I'm thinking about as your, one takeaway that I would want to sort of put a finer point on is, and this is a huge generalization, but is there sort of a spectrum where you might be in a studio visit where the artist's work is so rife with conversation, mm-hmm. but they're, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, like they're really inarticulate or they, you know, they're awkward or what have you, or vice versa, where the right. where the work is really like, I don't know where to go with this, but the person is really talkative. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Normally it's the latter.
Yeah.
I would find that even artists who are awkward or a little inarticulate or maybe nervous or uncomfortable, but are really doing interesting work, you can always tease out those conversations.
Yeah.
You know, it might take 1 or 2 visits. And if the work is really intriguing, then I'm going to put that time in to try to understand the person.
Yeah.
The opposite definitely happens more frequently where it's like, oh, I had a great conversation. It really sucks that I don't like their work.
Right.
So, you know.
Is Canada different, especially in the more far-flung places as far as the, you know, the codes of professionalism or the sort of mindset of professionalism in the artist in terms of, you know, having been to grad school, yeah. et cetera, et cetera?
I mean, I think what's interesting, the major difference between Canada and the U.S., I mean, there's lots of major differences, but especially in a country that, like, we always think of as, oh, they're just like us. It's like, no, no, is the government funding, is the fact that
right.
they recognize artists as with a capital A as a profession. Both that and the proliferation of artist-run spaces. So what you get in Canada is fewer artists who you see are banking on, oh, I did this series of works, people liked it, I'm going to keep doing this series of works. So instead, you see artists who are making these wild swerves and following what they want to do because there's a system there that supports it. On the downside, there's not, you know, it's growing, but like the collector base isn't as huge, and that's also hard. But it's a really interesting balance.
It's interesting to think, though, you know, and you can, I'm sure, speak much more to this, that with that swerving, you know, path of art making, which sounds really intriguing to me,
mm-hmm.
then you mentioned the, you know, the big names of Canada who,
right.
I mean, you know, there's, I mean, certainly, is it Douglas Gordon? Is he, yeah. he has quite a variety, but you know, yeah. like Jeff Wall has kind mm-hmm. of been doing the same thing for, yeah. for decades. Right.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
I mean, does anybody in Canada, if not the US for that matter, who takes a swerving pattern, does that end up coming out,
right.
you know, in yeah. a visible way?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think of somebody like Michael Snow, who I think is, you know, fascinating.
Is he Canadian?
He is Canadian.
Okay.
There's also the secret Canadians, you know, right. all those people that you're like, wait, they're Canadian?
Right.
I had David Rakoff wrote an essay in the catalog for the show right before he passed away about being an American Canadian.
right. And David, and I'll just interject that David Rakoff is the late one of the most beloved This American Life mm-hmm. storytellers.
Yes. Yeah. yeah. I still yeah. remember the day I picked up my phone. I had left him just a cold message and my phone rang and I picked it up and I heard his voice, which is so iconic. And he just said, "Tell me I'm not too late." And I was like, "You're not too late." It was perfect.
Wow.
So wait, what were we saying?
We were talking about Michael Snow and people
Michael
like
Snow.
That. Yeah.
So Michael Snow, if you look at the breadth of his career, yes, he's known as this structuralist filmmaker and he's continued to do that. But I remember a couple years ago, he had a sculpture show at the Art Gallery of Ontario and it was spectacular. And I'd never seen his sculptural work before that wasn't film related. He's also a pianist and does, you know, contemporary experimental music. And, you know, it's like you can look over that career and see him having tried all of these things. And it's kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know?
So, you know, again, the subtext seems like, you know, when you say Canada, there's so much like us, but they're also so much not like us.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, we're talking about the many ways that they get it right when it
yes.
comes to the arts, in which
yes.
we don't. Do you feel like with Mass MoCA, you have somewhat of an opportunity to, you know, make an impact in that way?
I do. And I think the way we work with artists and the way we try to support artists in terms of giving them opportunities to make work that they wouldn't have made before. I mean, the Nick Cave show is a perfect example. We fabricated that entire show in our workshop.
Right.
And, you know, that's not something he would have been able to build just anywhere. Because also most places don't have, you know, most places have an installation or preparator team. Well, we call ours art fabrication.
Yeah.
They're all sculptors. They're all makers. They can make anything. And that's what we sometimes lack in our hard cash, we make up for in those ways.
Right. Right.
And that's also why working with an artist for multiple years means that we can really develop ways of doing that. And, you know, I always joke that, and artists say this all the time, that we spoil them because they're like, but you just keep saying yes to us. And we're like, well, we'll say no when we have to, either when we've run out of money or, you know, that will actually ruin the structural integrity of our building or it will really hurt someone. We'll say no then.
Yeah.
But we're not going to say no before we know that it's not possible.
Well, in the case of Nick Cave, you have an established artist mm-hmm. who you're giving just an amazing
yeah.
physical and logistical platform for. Mm-hmm. What?
But it was more than that. So, you know, mm-hmm. Nick was somebody I'd been following for a long time. And of course, everybody knows the sound suits and they're spectacular. But I saw a piece of his in an art fair. It was a cast iron blackface lawn jockey holding a bouquet of flowers. And I was like, that's something different. And so I went to his studio, and with artists like that, really established artists, I like to give them the curveball of like, give me something you haven't done before.
Right.
So I went to Nick's studio, and the first time I met him, I said, I want you to do an exhibition in this space, building 5, the football field. I said, I don't want you to make a single sound suit. And he paused, and I was like, okay, this is where it's going to go really well or really bad. And he just said, ooh, girl, thank you. And I knew we were off.
Right, right.
And so to me, it's like we show a lot of emerging artists, giving artists their first, you know, first big shows. But then when it comes to somebody like that, how can we give him something that he's never been sure. able to do before?
Right, right. Yeah, so, but as far as the emerging artist, that's kind of where I was going. Mm. Are you able to put their show in one of the smaller spaces so it's like not too, you know, overwhelming yeah. an opportunity?
It's you know, it's a variety. So, you know, our spaces do fluctuate. We have, you know, building 5. We've got a 3-story high gallery. We've got some smaller spaces. So it, you know, it depends on what their work is and what they're up for and things like that. But I don't ever want to give somebody an opportunity that will set them up to fail, but I want to push them in the right way.
Yeah. Well, what are some maybe minimal qualifications for you to have an emerging artist show? In other words, what kind of proof do you need, if not for your director, for yourself,
that says,
I can do this?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to... It's a kind of ineffable thing. It's like, it's a feeling. And there goes back to that, like, it's personal. Like, sometimes you can see that somebody, you know, maybe they've only done a few, a small show, but yet you see in that the potential, whether it's, you know, how it's made or how they're thinking about space. Because, you know, we have big spaces, but that doesn't mean we always need to put big stuff in them.
Yeah, sure.
So it's about understanding the power of scale. And then it just has to be something that connects with me. So, you know, for instance, there's a artist, Lily Cox Richard, who's based now in Richmond, Virginia. But I was a guest curator at Art Pace in San Antonio, and which took me all across Texas to meet artists, to pick an artist to do a residency. And she was based in Houston then. And I did about 25 studio visits across Texas. And she was the last one. And I sort of knew immediately when I met her, like, okay, that's the one. And we worked together on this show.
How much of it was from meeting her, you know, versus the work itself, would you say?
It was like the magical combination of both.
Right.
Like, I, of course, looked at the work online, and I was like, oh, this is really interesting. And then I met her, and it just clicked.
You knew she was a genius right then.
Yes. But I also knew she was a thoughtful artist, you know, that she was really, and dealing with really interesting histories. And you know, her whole show was about the idea of stewardship and how we can take care of each other better, but she also made these, like, badass sculptures. And so I worked with her on this Art Pace show. So she did a 2-month residency and made a show as the result. And then I asked her to come and do a show at Mass MoCA.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's of, you know, probably 10 times more space than the last show, but I know she's up for it, and I'm excited. And it's not till 2021. So we have time, and I'm excited to sort of work with her over that time and see what she does.
When one, so you've been involved with shows, obviously, that have a very long arc, right? There's
yes.
There's the incarnation, and then there's the show itself mm-hmm. several years later. So yeah. That's like this long arc of time, you
yes.
know, from discovery to studio visit to mm-hmm. planning to the show itself mm-hmm. to the et cetera, et cetera. So where was I going with this? there is a question here. In your typical 5 to 10 year scenario,
yeah.
how many of those artists are able to make a living during that time from just their work? And how much does that factor in to right. you working with them?
Yeah. It doesn't factor into me working with them. I would say a very small amount make their money through their work. I think that's
reassuring.
Very much the case in, you know, the art world. Lots of people teach, lots of people, you know, like I said, our whole art fabrication crew, they're all artists. They work at museums,
sure.
they put up shows. I think the one thing that's the hardest for artists to do is be other artists' assistants. I think that's like a
amen,
tough
sister.
Thing. but I think almost every artist I know is always on a hustle.
Right. Well, let me be more specific. So this woman that you were just talking about, what's her name again?
Lily.
Yeah. So Lily's got a show. It's 2018. She's got a show in 2021.
Yep.
How much money is Mass Mocha going to give her between now and then?
I don't know yet. And I always try. I always try to put a little money in different budget years. It's usually, I would say, within the 2 years leading up to, rather than 4 years, just because I then have all the shows in those 2 years. But I always try to, like Trenton Doyle Hancock, for instance, I'm doing a show with him next year, and I gave him production money this year. So when I can. And I think it's important that museums pay artists and help out with all of that stuff. So, yeah.
Isn't he, by the way, an artist who is a market successful artist?
He does.
Yeah.
Trent definitely, like, you know, he doesn't teach or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, Nick Cave certainly the same, but he still teaches.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's kind of interesting to think about, and I don't know if, you know, you need to think about it or even want to, but it is interesting to think about the merging, the intersecting of market artists, you know, and museum artists, because it's an interesting dynamic. You know, sometimes you think of, I wanted to mention this at some point or later. I don't know if this is the best time to mention it, but this guest that I had several years ago, who at the time was working at a local museum, now she's with a gallery, but she said something to the effect of, not all work is meant to be for a museum, you know? And that really stuck with me, and it really describes, you can take that so many different directions, but one of them is that there's a je ne sais quoi about museum work, you know, that you sometimes feel like conflicts with the market, you know, but other times they merge perfectly somehow.
Well, and then there's the times, you know, where, you know, an artist might be doing a project in one of our giant spaces and they're like, yeah, I mean, my gallery is excited for me to have this opportunity, but they're not going to get anything out of it. They can't sell anything from this show because it's temporary and it's, you know, so it is that really interesting.
And that's really, we
do that a lot.
That's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
Because in fact, they're wrong.
Right.
Because the museum is only going to boost their value.
Of course. And I think they understand that as well. But it's just like, you know, oh, they're happy for the artist, but it's like they don't always know what to do with what the artist is making in that situation.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
And not true of all galleries, of course.
Well, before we get off Nick Cave and this area altogether, I think we would be remiss if you didn't maybe tell your jockey acquiring story.
Yeah, talk about stranger danger. So part of Nick's show was that he wanted 17 cast iron vintage blackface lawn jockeys. So one of the elements of the show was this crystal cloud, and the whole top was covered in found objects. The bottom was chandeliers, and he's been using these racist memorabilia in his work for a few years now, in trying to both pull it out of circulation and to elevate it. And so the jockeys were to be the keepers of this sort of heaven realm. And which meant, you know, we had a couple of years where we were sourcing lawn jockeys. And so I had an intern who was just like always on eBay on lawn jockey duty, and we would find them. And, there was one that we found that Nick really liked, and it was in Marblehead, Mass, I think it was. I grew up in Boston, and so not far from, or outside of Boston. So it wasn't far from where I was going to be for Thanksgiving. And they wouldn't, we could buy the jockey, but they wouldn't ship it. So I said, oh, I'm going to be out there. I'll just go pick it up. And so, you know, this is the day after Christmas, not Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And I drove out there, and this community is a pretty affluent community. And I was driving, and all of a sudden there was a house, and it had a sign on the front that said white trash. There was like a giant fence, and then other signs that said security cameras, And my GPS said, "You have arrived." And I was like, "Oh, shit." And so I pulled into the driveway, and there was like a snowmobile and a boat and a carnival ride in the driveway. And then sitting there was the lawn jockey. They told me it would just be outside. And so I picked it up, and those things are heavy. I picked it up, and I put it in the trunk of my car, and I was like, I feel really gross having this in my car. And luckily I had a blanket. So I like threw a blanket over it because I was like going into Boston to have dinner with friends, and I have a hatchback so you can see in. I was like, right. I can't let people see in the back of my car.
Yeah.
And so I pulled down to the bottom of the driveway to call my friend and say, I'm on the way. And I guess I lingered too long, and they had cameras because a woman who I don't think had very many teeth came out and started screaming at me. You know, what are you doing here? You're trespassing. And I had to utter the phrase, I bought the lawn jockey. And she was like, okay, get out of here. And I was like, this just all felt bad.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. I had another one of my colleagues, our exhibition manager, Caitlin, went to pick one up that again was like near her family in New Jersey. And the guy wanted to tell her like all about how this object had been in their family. And she was like, I was texting my friend my GPS coordinates because he was like, just come in the house, just come in the house. And she was like, nope, nope, gotta go. And of course, we told Nick these stories and he said, I never go pick them up. It's the things we do for art.
So is in fact, to what extent is he really trying to take, is it an ongoing project to take these things out of circulation?
It's, yeah, definitely ongoing.
And does he have assistants who are like doing the same thing that your intern was doing? Kind
yeah, of? He, that, I mean, he travels around and wherever he goes, he'll go to antiques markets and thrift stores and things like that.
Right.
But yeah.
And is he, is another step going to reappropriate them for art or not necessarily?
Yeah.
All of them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's sort fascinating. Of
change their meaning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To,
sure.
You know, shift how we can experience them.
Right. Got it. Yeah. I guess I want feel like I can mine a little bit more as far as what you do as far as collaborating and helping with the artists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was certainly a special case, and it was clearly the results paid off,
yes.
You know, in this show, right? but is there a line maybe that's a line too far for you sometimes when you're collaborating with an artist and they end up? And let me just speak from sort of a secondhand personal experience, because mm-hmm. I know somebody who works in a very modest museum, and they get into situations with artists from time to time where they haven't met them in person before. They
right.
come on site, and sometimes they end up being ridiculously high maintenance. And
yes.
I guess maybe through your studio visits, you know, yes. have that filter beforehand.
Right, yeah. I don't think I've ever asked an artist to do a show before meeting them. I think that's, but you know, sometimes you meet somebody and you get along great, and as you're working on a project, they become high maintenance and you're like, didn't see that one coming, and you just have to deal with it. But I think that thing of knowing what you're getting into, because if you are going to be entering, it's a relationship for 3 to 5 years of working with somebody. You gotta know that you're gonna be able to
yeah.
do this together.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I always struggle a little bit with the word collaboration. I know the way I work is collaborative, but I never want to put myself in front of an artist or take any sort of credit for their creative output. But, you know, it is that thing of when you work together for that long, you're having conversations, you're saying, well, what if it this way or that way? And so like, there's this way of it being productively collaborative, but not labeled as a collaborative thing in
sure.
the end. And I
right.
think that's a fine line. And especially I think, you know, I kind of hate the word curator because I don't think it really gets to what I do. I think producer is more akin
mm-hmm.
Because it's not just about like my taste making, but it really is about helping an artist produce what they can. And whether that's, you know, driving to a crazy house and picking up a lawn jockey, or even, you know, being in there and installing with the artists. And, you know, I had a exhibition with Neri Ward, and he wanted these dried mango pits. And so my intern found that the National Mango Board would send us a pallet load of mango pits, but yet they still were all fleshy. So we needed to clean them and dry them. And of course, the only place to do that was in my kitchen. So we would bring them home and we'd boil them and scrape them and bake them in the oven. And I mean, there were days where I went upstairs to the bedroom and I was like, I can still smell it. And everybody's like, but mangoes smell nice, but not when you're baking the pits and not when they're rotting because there's so many of them. And then, of course, the most hilarious thing was, you know, Neri made these incredible sculptures that they were sort of embedded in. And the sculptures were made out of foam, like mattress foam, and which was almost the exact same color as the mango pits. And he put them in and he was like, huh, you can't really see them. And I was like, I'm going to kill you. And then he said, do you think we should have mango salsa at the opening? And so, you know, when you get to a point where you're working with an artist that long and you can really, you know, tease each other like that, you know, it's perfect.
That's good.
But it was years before I could eat a mango. I can finally do it again.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's sort of another question. It's like, well, what the first question that I was thinking of as you were starting to describe that was, do you feel, and these questions I think are going to tie into each other, mm-hmm. do you feel for the most part adequately appreciated? You know, do you feel the great gratitude, yeah, of the artist in most of these cases? And then secondly, you know, is there a fine line between being a producer and being a slave? You know, if that's, yeah, not too charged a word to use.
Right. I definitely feel appreciated. Like 100%.
Whether or not they thank you when they do their sort of intro speech,
yeah,
of the show.
Yeah, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And you know, part of it is like, I look at my life and my friends and the people who are closest to me are artists I've worked with and formed these bonds with. So that's, to me, a testament of that appreciation.
Yeah.
And then I don't think I've ever felt like a slave. I think I always sort of do what needs to get done. You know, if I see the thing and I'm like, oh, he wants these mango pits, and like, well, let's try out and see what we do. See how to make this work. I've never thought twice about sort of jumping in and doing the manual physical thing.
Sure.
I mean, I once did a project with Mark Dion. It was hilarious. We were doing a project in Pennsylvania, and part of it, we were building a cemetery, and we had to do a dry stone wall. So the organization we were working with got somebody to donate all this rock, and it got dumped on this site, and then they had no volunteers, nobody to help us build it. So Mark and I built this wall, and we finally said, you know, we really need some help. And they're like, we've got some volunteers coming for you tomorrow. And a bus pulled up, and about 25 Girl Scouts got off the bus. And Mark and I just looked at each other, and we were like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, they couldn't even lift the rocks. So then the next day I was like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go to the high school and get the football team. And that's what we did, and they helped us finish the wall.
For no pay?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think we bought them, like, pizza and stuff like that.
Wow.
And, you know, so, yeah.
Well, as you were describing, though, the mango thing, and I'm sure there are other examples, too, and it's funny in light of, you know, what you said about how artists probably the least maybe desirable job is being a studio assistant. You know, I mean, I guess you can rationalize it and say, well, you know, this is part of a bigger,
yes,
pie. This is a big part of a bigger piece.
Yes.
But there is a very studio assistant. Neri is going to go off and, you know, and make the larger sculpture.
Yeah.
And you're going to be one, mm-hmm, of the helpers,
yeah,
that does the mango pits.
And I'm happy to do that. Like, I'm not the kind of person who wants to sit at my desk. And if a show's being installed, I'm not at my desk. Because, like, you know, another one was, you know, with the Nick Cave show, we had, it's like, all of these crystals that had to hang from the bottom of this cloud. And,
yeah.
one of my favorite stories that came out of that is at one point, Nick was talking to our assistant curator, Allie, and we were trying to figure out how many crystals did we need to buy? How many strands? And, you know, no, none of us had ever built a crystal cloudscape before. So it's kind of hard to estimate. Uh-huh. And he said to her, and also crystals are expensive. So we were saying, like, can we use some acrylic ones? And he said, yeah, 75% can be acrylic, but the remaining 50% should be glass. And she said, but Nick, that's 125%. And he said, exactly. And I actually have that tattooed on my finger, 125%, as a reminder
that
is always what I want to give to a show. And whether it's, you know, and then when we were installing, you know, the crystals come in long strands, I was there with everybody, you know, making them into smaller strands.
Right.
It's that same thing of like, I don't want to feel like anybody's working for me. I want to feel like we're working together.
Sure.
And like, those are the artists that do best at Mass Mocha too. Like Nick was in there doing the same thing. And so it becomes these little communities in that moment.
Right. I imagine though that you've had some shows, maybe very few, where it's fairly cut and dry, you know, the work comes in, you put it up. So since you're wanting to stay away from your desk, you know, and be involved with the installation, mm-hmm. does that mean that you're like trying it out all sorts of different ways, you know, or?
I don't do that too much. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was in grad school, my thesis show I was installing, and I made the mistake of saying, I want this piece on this wall. And it was a Heimsteinbach, one of his shelves with all these objects on top of it that are, you know, measured and put in place by the millimeter, very precise. And I was in class when they installed and I came out and I was like, I'm really sorry, but we need to move it. And I felt sick because I hadn't made the decision right the first time. And so I try not to ever hang something and then have to move it. Sometimes I'll shuffle things around before they're up. But yeah, I mean, and just spending time in the space, like say when a group show is going up that a lot of it is existing work, you know, just sort of having the paintings on the floor or something for a while. And, you know, all of that is 'cause it has to, you know, it has to go together conceptually, but it also has to feel right in the space.
Yeah.
But I try mm-hmm. to work out a lot by like doodling on floor plans and, things like that. Now, of course, we use SketchUp, too, which I don't know how to use, but...
I don't either. We have something in common. So your thesis show was a curatorial effort.
Yes. Yeah. So I went to Bard Center for Curatorial Studies.
Mm.
And so it's a two-year program. And in the second year, you curate a show and write your thesis about that. So
who else other than Haim Steinbach?
It was Haim Steinbach, Louise Lawler, Suan Kwan, Moira Davey, and Mark Weintraut. It was called Shelf Life, and it was all about artists who use collected objects in their work from their own collections.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was a MA in curatorial studies or something like that?
Yes, yeah.
To what extent did you have like art history in your education?
Yeah, art history was undergrad.
Okay, yeah.
But even then, you know, I love art history, but even as an undergrad, I knew I wanted to work with living artists from the get-go.
Right.
So most of my, you know, I took all of the survey classes, but most of my concentration was sort of post-war onward.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the gist of what I'm getting at is that one can still be in the museum world and sort of have an art history background it be more, you know, be more of an art history minded person.
Yeah.
And you're very much not that.
I'm very much not that, though I deeply respect it. But, you know, of course, the thing is, it's like history was yesterday.
True.
You know, in many ways.
In the scheme of the history of the world. Yes.
Yeah. And like I was having a conversation with an art historian the other day and he was saying, because he mostly focuses on contemporary, people are like, well, how are you a historian? And he was like, well, I'm still an art historian because I'm like contextualizing it within a greater history. But, you know, because you're dealing with the contemporary, it doesn't mean you're not also thinking about those other things.
Yeah. And, you know, another, we can talk about, we can debate the producer, curator label and so on.
Right.
But, but to me, what's most poignant is that you're much closer to being an artist in a lot of ways than being a curator. You know what I mean? Like you're a very artist oriented.
Yes.
Whatever. Yeah. Curator.
Well, and I think, you know, when I was in high school and college, I was a maker. And so I sort of came to curating from doing.
Yeah.
And all of my first jobs, internships in museums were with the preparators and the registrars.
Mm.
And so I really came at it from that very tangible, you know, point.
Yeah.
And as much as I love scholarship and I love theory and, but I also think there's a sort of democracy that is missing when you only look at that. You know, I always joke, even when I'm writing a book, that I want my colleagues to appreciate it and my mother to appreciate it.
Right.
So I think then being able to like vacillate between those things is the key to getting there.
Yeah. Is it easier to write when you've been, you know, doing all the making stuff, you know, you go back to it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, still often there's many times where I'm guessing what it will be because we also commission a lot. But it's also easier because of those conversations. I've spent many, many hours talking to the artists and...
Do you ever take notes when you're having a long studio visit?
I don't.
So you just internalize it?
I internalize it. I feel like when I take notes, it takes me out of it. I'm lucky.
That's what I tell my old therapist.
I'm lucky to have a really good memory.
Right.
But yeah, I don't take notes. I mean, when I'm researching, when I'm getting ready to write and like reading things, I take sort of ridiculously stupid extensive notes. And, you know, I did a show about Wonder called Explode Every Day and ended up writing a, you know, 30 page essay out of 175 pages of notes just because I love research wormholes. You know, it's like, oh, I'm reading whatever, Descartes, and he mentions Lucretius, so I have to read Lucretius. And then, you know, you keep getting deeper and deeper, and then you're like, you got to pull yourself out of that. But I just love that.
That's the art historian in you.
Yeah, it is. It is. But then at the same time, I remember back when I was in grad school, I wrote this paper, and I quoted Radiohead in the paper. And I remember a professor being like, you can't do that. And I was like, why not? And so I always make it my mission to also refer to music and literature.
Did the professor ultimately succumb?
Not really. I mean, I don't think they like super marked me down, but they were still not having it. actually made me want to do it more.
I wonder if that's a generational thing or just stuck in the mud thing.
Yeah, I think part of it was, you know, when I went to this program, it was the very early years of it. And the whole point of that program is to ground curating in theory. And so this was a non-theoretical intrusion.
Right.
Which, you know,
are
way more fun.
Well, speaking of writing, remind me the title of the book that you're working on.
Yes. Do This Instead.
Do This Instead, which is about curating.
Which is about curating. So I've been working on it with another curator, Ian Alden Russell, who's a curator at Brown University. And we were introduced a couple years ago by Mark Dion, and both of whom we'd work with. And he was like, you guys are going to like each other. And we realized we had similar paths. Like we both came to curating through technical roles and through doing.
Mm-hmm.
He's also, you know, anthropologist and studied history and all of that. And talking to him the first time, I just realized it was a kindred spirit thing. And I was teaching a class at Williams College, and we brought him in. I was co-teaching it with Lisa Doran, who works at the College Art Museum. And it was for their grad program for, you know, these budding curators. And so I brought Ian in and we started to talk about this notion of the curator as producer. And we're like, this could be a book. And so Right now, it's still all theoretical, but the more I say it, the more like, you know, we'll will it into being. But the idea behind it is that we're going to break the book down. The chapters are going to be the different kinds of roles that curators adopt. So the producer, the therapist, the party planner, you know, all of these things that, you know, curators do. And we're going to both talk to people who do those professions and also curators in terms of their roles relating to that. And really our goal for it is that it's not only a handbook for people who are interested in the field of curating, but for artists to actually be able to point to the curators who are working in this way.
So in other words, the curators are at one time or other all of these roles.
Yeah. We sort of went through lots of different titles, you know, editor and this and that, and sort of landed on about, I think it was 10 that we felt got to the gist of it.
What are some others that you come to mind?
Let me see if I can remember them. The producer, the therapist, confidant, the undertaker, I think is an interesting one. You know, when you have to be the person to usher an artist through a project that is failing, or be the person to say, like, this isn't going to work for whatever reason, whether it's there's not enough funding or structurally that actually won't stand up, and how to be able to be gentle in that.
Have you had to do that?
I mean, I've definitely had to steer artists in different directions so that, you know, things would work out. Yeah.
So you kept them from going under.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And therefore you.
The pre-undertaker, right. I guess. The hospice worker, I don't know what to call it.
Right.
And then there's, definitely like the event planner, and that sort of the social aspect of it.
And so you're going to be, if I understood you right, you're actually going to be interviewing event planners.
Yes.
For the book as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Event.
Yeah. That's where it actually potentially takes on almost a mainstream kind of accessibility, right?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's this interesting thing because, you know, I'm sure as you've noticed, the word curating gets thrown around a lot. You know, it's like, you know,
it's some people.
I've curated my Spotify playlist. And you know, I don't really get bent out of shape over that, but, you know, here's this kind of reverse of us saying, well, curators do all these things too, but, you know, the person who curates their Spotify playlist doesn't talk to a curator. And so it was really important for us to also talk to those people.
Yeah.
I remember putting together a talk for our intern program to sort of talk to them about this idea of curator as producer. And I Googled the word curator, which I can't believe I hadn't done before, and Google image. And the first two pictures that came up were like, you know, a middle-aged woman in a like beaded jean jacket with like chunky jewelry, like straightening a picture on a wall and smiling. And then a kind of tortured looking European man looking pensive. And I was like, nope. So, you know, I think there are a lot of books out there about curating, but I like that this one, or hopefully this one, will go more towards that kind of doing.
Yeah. There was a wig in Jim Shaw's wig museum that was the curator that was pretty funny.
Oh, yes, I saw that. Yes, that was hilarious. Yeah. And, you know, two of the pieces in that show were commissioned at Mass MoCA.
Yeah, so you work with him.
Yeah.
Right. Well, do you feel like there's anything that we left out in this span of your work and life?
Did we leave anything out? I don't think so. I think we hit a lot of good stuff.
We hit a lot of good stuff, right?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was awesome.
And we're out.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you very much to Denise again for coming to talk to me. I appreciate the effort. Very thoughtful of her to stop by. And I hope you guys enjoyed that. And we're going to move on to the art fair, art season, and some bitching and moaning about them in a second. I'm also going to tell you about that digital slideshow, which I highly recommend. But before I get there, just give me a moment to remind you that This is a listener-supported show, supported by you, the listener. Very much appreciated indeed when you donate to the show, either one time via PayPal or ongoing via Patreon. And I appreciate the recent several donations, some of them coming from a couple of people who really wanted to hear the extra Dan Fox material. I also have some extra Scott Ogden footage as well that I haven't released yet. So if you want to jump on board and become a $25 or more one-time donator via PayPal, or at least $3 per month via Patreon, I would be happy to send you those plus the other ones. We're going to have five bonus episodes now with this Scott Ogden one. So, and you can, by the way, if you're not necessarily concerned with getting bonus materials or My Undying Love, you are certainly welcome to support the show for as little as a dollar a month on Patreon. That works too. If you can't or don't feel like you can afford financially to support the show, you can also support the show non-financially by leaving a fantastic five-star review on Apple Podcasts. Apparently it's not called iTunes, quote-unquote, anymore. You can also follow us on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And by the way, speaking of Instagram, if it hasn't already released, I think it probably has by the time this comes out. I'm recording on Wednesday, way, way early this week. But there's going to be a top five conversation episodes, and that's strictly going by popularity over the last 2 years. So if you want to find out who those top five are, and see some images to go along with them, follow me on Instagram at Artist Podcast. What else can you do? You can also spread the word. Just let more people know that you think this is a great art podcast and that they should listen to it. Thank you so much in advance for that. All right, now let's get to the news of the week, courtesy of the Weisslink, Jeff Weiss, former guest of this show, by the way. First, I wanted to tell you that there is an amazing slideshow. And it is just, all you have to do is do a search, Traces of Warmth, Thermal Images of London's Homeless. Photographer Gray Hutton spent the winter photographing homeless people with a thermal imaging camera. So not only is it an interesting visual story, it's also really interesting to hear about how the homeless are faring well and very not well in London currently. So go check that out. Just Google or DuckDuckGo, Traces of Warmth, Guardian UK, and you will get there. All right, now on to the art fair talk. So we've got the Armory, Nada, Spring Break, et cetera, et cetera. What, how many fairs am I leaving out? Probably another five or 10 even. So first one, Lisa Schiff, who is the high-end art advisor who has been on this show, says, Lisa Schiff, they are going to cut your VIP cards. And she is quoted by Alain Servais as saying, I don't like fairs because it's a pileup of merchandise, Miss Schiff cautioned collectors, particularly new ones, not to buy art at an art fair. That same atmosphere creates excitement, makes it hard to properly assess an artist, unquote, from Lisa Schiff. Now from ArtNet, about Team Galleries Jose Freire. And this is from ArtNet. The title reads, Team Galleries Jose Freire on why he is quitting art fairs for good. The central driver of the modern day art market, at least when it comes to galleries, is art fairs. Some dealers, especially the biggest ones, find this to be an immensely rewarding system. Others, especially smaller operations like Team Gallery, have begun to find them a losing bet. That's why after a final appearance at Art Basel Hong Kong later this month, Team founder Jose Freire says he will never do another art fair again. What kinds of things do people talk about when they talk about art fairs? All the conversations I've had are about how much people dislike them. I haven't had a conversation with anyone in memory that was about how terrific they thought art fairs were. Generally, you do an art fair and people ask you how the art fair went and you say, terrific. And then the art fair issues their proclamation of how the art fair went. Terrific. Everything is, quote, terrific. So I thought the best thing to do would to go up to colleagues and just let them know that while I'm sure it's terrific for them, it's not for me. If you open up and are very honest with people, all of a sudden the realization is that they're on the same page. And then one more art fair wine /complain comes from Jerry Saltz, who I don't like to quote because he's got enough of a platform already, but I thought this was appropriate for this line of complaining. It is time to change the art fair model, or dump it all together, or fairs pay galleries to exhibit there, put onus on fairs to earn their money. We're eating our galleries alive. Team Gallery, no more art fairs. And for fuck's sake, go to your local galleries. Go to as many as possible. 85% of dealers say they have to go to Hong Kong or god-awful Miami to see their local curators. Museums, cut off curators' art fair travel budgets. Make them see all local galleries. This is an emergency. All right, so that enough emphasis for you? And I'm going to say now, after all three of those pieces on experts complaining about the art fairs, if you go back not that long ago to my episode with Sarah Maria Salmone and Tyler Renfieri, her partner, of Mrs. Gallery in Queens, they talked very lovingly about the art fairs that they and their brief life as a gallery have experienced and how much they were looking forward to Miami. So I don't know, is this a contrast between people who are just entering the art fair environment and people who have been in it for decades? Perhaps. Anybody want to shed light on that? I'm all ears. And finally, before we go for this week /2 weeks, I always like to end with something amusing and perhaps schadenfreude-like. And that is from ArtNet once again, titled, "Want to back out of a winning bid? ? Try these excuses. Online bidders have blamed children, the family cat jumping on the computer mouse, and human error, accidentally bidding on Rodin when they meant to bid on Redon, to avoid paying for a work. Sometimes these excuses arrive after the buyer realizes the object is too large to fit in their living room," says auctioneer Robin Starr. Ouch. Ouch. Not making another good case for rich folks. Rich collectors. I think that's enough rich collectors for this week. Hope you guys are well. Hope you have a good couple of weeks. Do let us know what you think. Love to get your donations and other support. And thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.